work session right now on a federal grant application request. Mm-hmm. And there's two of them. But we don't have a quorum yet. So why don't I just tack this one back out and open up public hearing. Public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, and that senior and people with disabilities. The House, I understand, was late adjourning today, and so they're probably still trying to grab lunch. I suppose Bates just came in.
Yeah, he's right there.
Okay.
We never got this paper. Did you need this paper? Probably should.
Okay, we'll take over where we left off on last Thursday. Seems like I've lost a few days.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves, acting Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities. And Julie Huddleston is here, and we were just going to do the last finish up on rates and then move to income and medical services. And we want to have a brief, very brief discussion on the role of the Medicaid. Help me here.
Long-term care quality and reimbursement advisory council.
Just about slipped. So.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Julia Huddleston, Administrator of the Office of Rate Setting in the Department's Finance and Policy Analysis Cluster. We're on page 105 of the handout, just very briefly finishing up provider rates in long-term care. We had discussed last week facility care and facility rates and rate reductions that were proposed. I wanted to briefly point out the types of providers for which the department has not proposed rate reductions as part of the governor's balanced budget. And those include the client-employed providers. There's approximately 12,000 of these folks who are employed directly by clients to assist them with activities of daily living and with housekeeping-like tasks. These folks are represented by the Home Care Workers Union. Currently, we pay them on average for hourly providers, so people who go into someone's home on an hourly basis, we pay an average of $591 a month. And for people who actually live in the client's home, we pay on average $1,282 a month. We've not proposed any changes to the rates that are paid to Providence Elder Place. Providence Elder Place is a demonstration program run through Providence Health Systems in Portland that looks at a merging of acute and long-term care and a merging of a capitated Medicare and Medicaid rate. There's approximately 400 clients who are served through Elder Place. The long-term care portion of their rate right now is $1,748 a month. Additionally, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs pays about $350 a month towards cost of their care. And finally, we've not proposed any changes to the rates we pay for dementia care in residential care facilities and specialized dementia units through contract. We have and continue to have problems getting Medicaid access to such care, even at the rates we currently pay. So we've not proposed any change, and that current rate is $1,840 a month. And there's about 500 clients in residential care facilities being cared for in the specialized dementia units.
Where are most of the units located?
They're scattered throughout the state, Chair Winters. We can get you a listing of where these units are located, but they're pretty much... They are scattered throughout the state. They tend, like everything else, to be in the metropolitan areas more than in the rural areas. Finally, we wanted to remind the committee of the existence of the Medicaid Long-Term Care Quality and Reimbursement Advisory Council and of the process that the department needs to go through for any rate change with a fiscal impact of more than $100,000. Senate Bill 543 in 1995 created the council, and the council's made up of 12 people, appointed by the governor, the president of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House. The long-term care ombudsman is a standing member of the council. Five of the people on the council represent consumers. The long-term care ombudsman represents consumers, and the other six represent providers. Whenever the department proposes to make a change in its reimbursement methodology that would have a fiscal impact of more than $100,000, the department needs to present that change to the council and get the council's written advisory opinion, and then bring that opinion back to the assembly or back to the emergency board before the department institutes the change. We've followed that procedure for changes that are both increases and decreases in rates since 1995. And any changes of these rates, as is proposed in the governor's balanced budget, would be subject to that procedure, and we would intend to follow it.
And, Madam Chair, we wanted to raise that issue because there was some confusion early this session. Legislative Council had expressed concerns about the constitutionality of this process. And at one point there was an LC draft, I think from the co-chairs or one of the co-chairs, that would have made this process a review process for the legislature, but not the approval, the actual approval on the rate changes. So we just want to make sure that we're okay in terms of any rate reductions that go forward. And we're assuming we would convene the council, have them review that, bring that back probably during work session before you're finished, and that your adoption of any change rate schedules in the budget process and probably in the budget report would constitute that necessary approval.
I think that's been a process we used in the past. I recall even during some of our rebalance that issue came forward. And
okay, Madam Chair, we're done with rates, and we're ready to move to the next section, or did you want to take the mental health grants first?
We're still waiting.
Okay.
Would you check and see where Representative Westland, Representative Smith, and Smith. Here is Westland, so I...
Almost.
We need one more.
Yeah, you understand.
Margaret is right down the trail.
No,
we need a House.
We need a House member.
I'd be willing to vote twice as usual.
Never mind. We need a House member.
The House didn't get out till 12:45 today, so.
We now have a quorum.
No, we need another House member.
Have we called?
Is that Dan Hughes?
Hey, I might be late, but you were later, and it gives me a great deal of satisfaction.
That's not what she's implying.
He's still out of breath. But.
Yeah, I am still out of breath.
Are there any questions while we're still on rates?
Madam Chair, shall we go ahead?
Let's go ahead.
Madam Chair, we're going to turn to page 106. And I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Lopez, who administers our Office of Employment and Financial Benefits. And she is going to go through a lot of the income and medical issues associated with long-term care. We're going to start with the infamous income cap trust and some of the details and questions you had about that and how that affects long-term care policy. So we'll start with that, and we'll break whenever you would like on the grants.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Lopez, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Employment and Financial Benefits in the Department of Human Services, serving seniors and people with disabilities. And as James mentioned, I did want to start with a clarification and an explanation of income cap trusts and why, in looking at budget reduction scenarios, the use of modifying an income standard is very challenging for the department. Income cap trusts resulted from a lawsuit in the state of California. They're also commonly known as Miller Trusts, and it was Miller versus Ibarra. And basically what the court found was that states could not deny eligibility to individuals who were over their state standard. So when a state established a special income standard, it had to allow people an opportunity to spend down into long-term care services. So either they needed to offer a medically needy program, or they needed to honor income cap trust as a way for individuals to shelter some of their income and spend down into long-term care. In 1991, the department eliminated the medically needy program for long-term care services, and therefore we did become an income cap state. I wanted to walk through how an income cap trust works, and for the purposes of Senator Morris's, I guess, question about the $50,000 income level, we did use $50,000 in this scenario, but I wanted to let folks know the average income for the 1,100 folks who currently are receiving long-term care services that have an established income cap trust is $2,050. But I did want to point out there would be a way for an individual with $50,000 a year income to divert some of their income and buy into or spend down into long-term care services. Our discussion is, our example is an individual, Manuel, age 74, and he's married and lives in a nursing facility. His pension and Social Security benefits equal $4,200 a month. There are certain deductions that are required under federal law, and that would include a personal needs allowance. The personal needs allowance for an individual in a nursing facility is $30. That changes based on the living setting, and it can go up to $553.70 for someone in home and community-based services. We are required to allow a limited amount of trust administrative costs. James mentioned that prior to December 1, we didn't have an established limit on this amount, and we did allow deductions for the establishment of income cap trusts for the attorney fees associated with establishing those. We did modify our rules in November, effective December 1, to limit that deduction to $50. So that would be the maximum allowable deduction now for any administration or attorney fees associated with an income cap trust. You're also allowed to divert a certain amount to a community spouse. This is also federal spousal impoverishment law, and you can divert up to $1,493. If you have other health insurance or medical deductions that are licensed medical deductions in the state of Oregon, you're also allowed to put or shelter some of that income to pay those expenses. So in this scenario, what is left over after these deductions is $2,477. That amount would be used to pay towards the nursing care facility costs. We didn't add the nursing facility cost to this chart, but we could certainly do that. Effective July 1, that amount that you can divert to a community spouse does increase to $1,515. I did mention that there are currently about 1,169 folks who do qualify for long-term care services with an established income cap trust. That's about 4% of our entire long-term care population.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, and thank you for the information. Did you say that this is a presentation representing the average client being served in this manner?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, no. The average income for individuals with established income cap trust is $2,050. We used this example specifically to demonstrate how an individual with a $50,000 income might be able to shelter their income or divert their income in order to buy into or spend down into care.
I see.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you were to add the nursing cost, is that nursing home cost?
Correct, nursing facility cost.
What would that look like? What would that cost approximate?
Well, the approximate nursing facility rate, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but I believe it's about $3,700. So the individual in this scenario would be paying $2,477 of that cost.
I see. Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $93.53 proposed rate, is that on a 360-day rate or a 365-day rate? What's the multiplier?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'm not sure the $93.53 rate.
That was basic rate proposed on page 101. Am I on the right track?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes. And we're getting back into nursing facility rates, and I think I see Julia Huddleston coming up behind us.
My question, Madam Chair, was what do I multiply against 93.53? Is it 365 days?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, that is correct, 365 days.
Go ahead.
And Madam Chair, just...
James.
Madam Chair, again, the issue why we spent so much time this time on income cap trusts is going back from, I think, our first or second day when we went back and forth in terms of whether we would use income exclusively or levels of care combined with income as the rationale for making reductions. Even though income clearly is the more objective standard, we found, again, that if you didn't go all the way down to 100% of SSI, which literally throws out almost two-thirds of your long-term care population, that was the only way to exclude income cap trusts, and that's why we went back to the use of the priority levels as the predominant feature of making decisions about how we make the reductions as opposed to relying exclusively on income. So that's why this became, for us, in this particular budget cycle, such an important issue that we had to deal with.
While I have a quorum, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5030 and open a work session on federal grant application requests. And Bob Nichols, I believe that you are going to make the request.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Bob Nichol, Acting Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, also with the Department of Human Services. And yes, my purpose is to request retroactive permission for the submission of two different federal grants. The first of these is a grant to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and it would develop... It would provide transition and substance abuse treatment services to youth being discharged from Oregon Youth Authority institutions back into communities in three particular counties, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Marion. The application was due back in January, and it was submitted with the requisite prior notification, I think 2 weeks ahead of time, to co-chairs of the Legislative Emergency Board. And it's a grant for $500,000. Could, if we're successful in receiving it, it could continue on for up to a total of 4 years for a total of $2 million in federal funds. There are no state general fund involved here.
Excuse me. Senator Carter.
Thank you. I'm always blurred out. Bob, there's absolutely no, because this is what they're going to ask us in general committee, because I'm so hard on them. So, absolutely no state general fund request.
That's correct.
And even if we were to apply again in, up to the amount of years that we could possibly have this grant, no general fund request.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that's my understanding that there's no general fund involved here.
All right. So, you know they're going to give us a hard time, so I just have to be prepared having that ready. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Even though there is no general fund required, you said it's a four-year grant period?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's up to 4 years. The way I understand that this grant would work is if we were approved, it would be for 1 year at a time. So we're right now looking for the first year. I understand that there were some questions from Senator Schrader, Madam Chair, and it's appropriate, I would like to address those at this point. One question was, how does the grant relate to what Oregon Youth Authority is currently doing? And the answer to that is it supplements things that the Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Education have already begun doing. But what they've noticed is that particularly for the youth transitioning out of Oregon Youth Authority facilities, only about 25% of them who have alcohol and drug and mental health needs actually are making connection with the appropriate treatment services. Mm-hmm. So this grant specifically targets those kids. And apparently 97% of the kids who are in this project, which is called, I'll make sure I get the name correct, Project Support, which is a statewide collaborative, about 97% of the kids who are in that do have one mental disorder or a substance use disorder. And the issue is that the kids who get treatment have a success rate of staying out of additional incarceration about three times those kids who don't get access to treatment. Because we're experiencing other cuts, access to services is a key, not only in terms of the services availability, but also the coordination and transition for kids to get to those services. And furthermore, I understand that the target kids for this program are Hispanic and African American youth. So it's focused in particular on some cultural competency issues. So that's how the grant relates to things that OYA is currently doing. It enhances and expands on something that we've identified as being able to do a good job, but there are things that would make it much better. The second question from Senator Schrader was, can any of the grant funds be used to replace general fund? And the answer, I understand, to that is no. These are federal funds that can't replace. And I'd also add that this is an enhancement, something that isn't currently being done with Project Support. So it's not something that we currently have existing funds for.
So you're saying that there's no supplanting?
Madam Chair, I believe that would be the correct term.
So there's more.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reference to models for delivering evidence-based practices, integrated service, and developing coordinated services, could you elaborate on what those models might be? And what's behind my question is, if we get this grant, how much of it actually is going to be put into direct service as opposed to planning and creating models and doing things that aren't really addressing the point of service?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, let me answer the second question first, if I may. And I looked at the budget on this, and it looks like about 200, and I think it was 90,000 of the 500,000 actually goes into services themselves. So the bulk of the money goes there. That doesn't count the facilitation or the coordination piece, which is also critical because you not only have to have the services available, but you also have to get the kids connected, and that's the very thing that the coordination would do that apparently hasn't been going as well as it could have. So,
Mr. Bick.
Yeah, Bob, I think, Senator Morse, the question was on the other grant. One of them is on transitioning youth from OYA. The other one is based on evidence-based practices. And I think you were talking about the evidence-based practice grant. There are two of them
in the packet. There's one dated February 25th, 2003.
This is February 25th?
Yes. And then you have another one that's dated March 24th, 2003.
My question was with respect to February.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, so if I might say, I believe that somewhere we did use the term evidence-based practice in the OYA or Oregon Youth Authority grant application. So I think it's appropriate to think in terms of evidence-based practices in all areas right now. So I think the question is still well taken.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who's actually going to be giving these services? Existing personnel? Are you going to hire new FTEs? Are they going to be contracts or employees of the state?
Representative Bates, my understanding is that we would hire one additional full-time equivalent staff person for our office that would then work with all three counties, and that's the transition coordination piece. The other funds, the direct service funds, would be contracted out to appropriate service providers in the communities, not done with state staff.
What are the three counties?
Madam Chair, the three counties are Marion, Multnomah, and Clackamas. If I might add, that, Madam Chair, the reason for the selection of the counties was there was a particular interest in focusing on Hispanic youth and African-American youth, and that's where the majority of those youth are located.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, the goals of this are laudable and need to be done, and all of medicine is moving towards evidence-based practice, so I'm not, no argument there. I'm so always concerned we're hiring FTEs with federal funds, and then when the program runs out a year or two or 3 years later, who picks that FTE up? What happens to the program? And I have a hunch I know where that kind of goes to sometimes.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the intent would be to do this on a limited duration position, so whoever was hired would understand that this is a limited position. It's not. There's no intention to continue it past then.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If the agency is successful in obtaining the grant, they still must come back to the e-board or this body someplace to get approval.
Madam Chair, if they need limitation, they need to come back to this body or to the emergency board for limitation, but they do not need subsequent approval once they're allowed to apply.
Questions?
Senator Gordley and Nell.
Thank you. Well, first a comment. I really appreciate that the department is looking at funds, federal and others, I hope, that are targeted in this way, targeted to underserved youth in our state. With that said, I'm concerned about other cuts that are taking place in the Oregon Youth Authority budget. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, in those cutbacks in the governor's budget, and Mr. Britton, if you could help us with this piece, the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget, if we're doing anything to the youth authority budget that in any way jeopardizes these funds continuing to come to us for that three-year period of time, and if we are cutting in any manner that might jeopardize us from being competitive for other funds that would also continue to serve the same population. Again, this is a population that has historically been underserved.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I'm not familiar enough with the OYA budget or the Oregon Youth Authority budget to answer that question. I'd have to ask my colleague, Sheila Baker.
Madam Chair, if we could do that examination, just to be clear, that we're not doing something that's going to have a negative impact on our ability to continue to draw these other funds, these federal funds.
With this grant application? You can check it, but I wouldn't think. Is this a demonstration project?
Madam Chair, it's not my understanding that it would be a demonstration project.
Is it something that perhaps may be ongoing?
Madam Chair, I would have to check to see what the details beyond year four would look like. My assumption is that if it was successful, then that would give us more of a basis for diverting other funds or if it was appropriate at that time to come and request based on outcomes that we get to continue this kind of a project. But
I ask if this demonstration because normally they're usually short-term in nature in order to validate some hypothesis make some special emphasis on a particular group or groups. And with that, usually by the time they complete the project period and conduct their evaluation, then the question then becomes whether or not there is continuation of the effort. And that was my...
I guess
Senator Gordley.
Madam Chair, I guess one of the pieces I had in the back of my mind is this. I know that the Multnomah County Gang Transition Program, for example, is scheduled for a cut. So if we're cutting that, but at the same time we're doing something else over here with a a new federal commitment, then what does the rest of what does that do to the rest of the picture? Are we looking at is one side taking one action, looking at the other action that is being taken by another side? Is what I'm asking, and I may not be asking it elegantly, but.
And I think Mr. Britton's going to talk to OIA on to someone on that particular issue, Representative Smith, and then we'll get that back. Answer back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talk to me a little bit about retroactive approval.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we had notified the co-chairs of the emergency board, I think, well in advance, and there's a two-week advance notice. And because of various delays in staffing and legislative delays, we weren't able to come before you formally until now.
So this is the first opportunity you've had to come to us to ask for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Carter.
I am, for whatever reason, Bob and those guys found this grant opportunity. I'm very appreciative because I'm very upset with what I see right now happening in terms of African-American Hispanic youth, where the highest group of young men are involved in gang activity. And we're in my district alone, we've had about seven shootings, of which at least four of them have ended up in death. And the same thing is happening in other people in these other legislators' districts in Clackamas and in these three counties that that is concerned here. And a lot of it had to do with mental health. I mean, the National Institute of Health has said this, that gang activity is a mental health issue in this country. And yet we have not had the money nor the intestinal will to do anything about it. So I'm very proud of the fact that you're doing this and that the money is so targeted so we can hopefully deal with some of the issues of drug activity and mental health issues among among gang members in this state. So I'm very proud of this and will be very supportive of what you do in this area. And if I can help you any further after this, I'm really available to you to do that. Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I echo the support and applaud you for, you know, finding these resources. But I do have a very serious problem with the proposal and the statement that there would be $290,000 that would actually go to point of service. That leaves 42%. That's 58% that actually of the grant that is going to treatment. And if we're looking at 42% that's going into creating modeling and doing things that are not helping people, I have a problem with that. And help me cross that threshold of approval in my mind.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I found the budget real quick, and so I'm no longer relying solely on memory. The contractual funds for treatment services are $297,000. There is $87,649 for evaluation, $3,150 for training. Because there's a great deal of coordination and travel that's going to be required here, there's also a pot of money for travel. The actual personnel costs are $54,000. There's $13,000, almost $14,000 for a project director part-time. There's a transition specialist for $37,380. There's an administrative specialist chunk of $3,600. And then you add the fringe benefits. The total for all that comes to $24,000 for fringe benefits. So that gives you more of a more complete picture of where the funds go.
Just to kind of clarify these, and I'm sure it is a demonstration grant, and I'm, you know, just from hearing what you have to say and applying for the grant, the state actually, I know you are required to have an evaluation component because the federal government is not going to have you do a demonstration grant without having the evaluation component that talks about the outcome and what you achieve. So you have both the ability, you both have to collect the data as well as implement a program as well as evaluate the program, if that puts it someone in context of what the feds would probably no doubt require of this as the other one that I think we'll probably hear about also.
Madam Chair, let me clarify. When I commented that I didn't think it was an or a demonstration grant, I think that is not in the title, but I think in concept you're absolutely right. It's a demonstration
grant. Grants manager for the state, and most of them that come out from the feds are demonstration, or either demonstration or research. That's usually what the feds send us. And unless they're in entitlement or categorical kinds of activities, and on those they always will require evaluation, some form of research, some form of data collection, and then usually it's not a whole heck of a lot for the actual service delivery. I want to share echo that I think that it's long overdue, and I wish that there were more dollars that were put into this to address this issue. Substance abuse is a huge issue in the state, and it's a huge issue among the population that we're talking about. And I think that I would like to see more in working with young people to get them clean and so that we can make help to make them productive. So I support the efforts, and I do hope that the federal government agrees with whatever the application says and will send us the money as quickly as possible. Is there any further discussion? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible for us to review the budgets for both grant requests prior to making an approval of this grant? I just get back to the issue of, is the money going where we want it to go, or is it going to go into things that are not point of service, that maybe don't have to be there? Now, for me personally to come in and second guess the planning that's been done, that's a little difficult. But I would like to look at the detail of the grant requests.
I'm sure the agency can give you a copy of the grant request. If you know, they just don't give us that you're welcome to have the whole grant application package that goes back to the
federal. Just the budget summary.
Yeah, well, the grant application and the budget are all tied together in what they send back to the federal government, which, you know, dots all the I's and cross all the T's. And Bob, you can make that available to Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'll be happy to do that for both grants.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. Continuing on. Senator Schrader had one other question, and that was anything, specifically State General Fund, reduced from this program during the special sessions? And from the mental health and addiction side, the answer is yes. We've had a series of cuts, and we outlined those for you during the Ways and Means presentation. I understand the co-chair's budget has an additional $5 million cut in state general fund cuts. So that having some federal funds to help assure that there are services available through this project would be a very nice thing, given the fact that there are continued uncertainties about state general funds available. Okay. Moving on to the evidence-based practice.
Do you want to take these one at a time? We're going to take them in block.
It's whatever you'd like to do, Madam
Chair.
Let's
take them in block. Go ahead.
Right. Moving on then, Madam Chair, to the evidence-based practice grant. This is also a retroactive request. Similar set of circumstances led to us not being able to present this until now. This grant would help establish two local what we call evidence-based practice centers, specifically to show how services to adults who have severe and persistent mental illnesses and alcohol and drug problems can be better served through an evidence-based practice process. We're also involved, as I think I mentioned during earlier presentations, with Dartmouth, New Hampshire Psychiatric Research Center on some similar kinds of grants. This would allow us to move two typical community mental health programs into evidence-based practices for people with these kinds of co-occurring disorders. It would allow us to have one limited duration position at the state for the next 3 years, if we're funded for that long, to help coordinate the evidence-based practice work around co-occurring disorders. The grant would seek a first-year funding of $325,000. It's also a Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration grant. And if we were successful in the first year, we would have an opportunity to go for an additional 2 years, also at $325,000, also entirely federal money. Senator Schrader also had three questions on this. So with Madam Chair's permission, I'll go into those and then see if there are other questions. Will this grant lead to cost savings or higher expenditures to care for these persons? The answer to that is that this grant in and of itself won't do that. It'll neither increase or decrease other costs, but it will give us a better idea about how we can more efficiently change practice cultures so that we get better results for the money that we have available to us, whether it's state or federal money. The second question is, does the grant answer how much money is enough to spend to get reasonable outcomes for persons with mental illness? Again, I think the answer to that would be that the grant would help us understand better what reasonable outcomes are. However, it's really not directed primarily to that. It's really directed at how do you change practice cultures and get them to change to do what we already understand from the practice literature needs to be done. The third question is, would this grant establish different performance outcomes? I don't believe that the performance outcomes that can be gained from providing evidence-based practices to this population are unclear at all. I think we need to, the outcomes are reducing hospitalization, reducing alcohol and drug usage, increasing housing stability, decreasing crisis services, increasing employment. So those, I think the outcomes are very clear. I don't think this grant would contradict any of that. I think it would help us clarify that, but I don't think there's a lot of new ground to be broken there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corker.
Thank you. It appears that this grant would allow us to move in the direction that was laid out in House Bill 3024, the mental health alignment or the mental health planning bill from last session. I think it was last session. And that was legislation flowing from the governor's mental health alignment work group. Am I mistaken in looking at this particular grant as an opportunity to help us carry that work forward?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, this is exactly what this grant would help us do, is move in that kind of direction.
That's great.
Okay. Well, I noted that the quarterly report form tool came from the University of Kansas.
Madam Chair, I noticed that, too. That's a very good thing, in my opinion. University of Kansas is not only my alma mater and the senator's home state, but it's also been a leader in the area of strength-based case management, and we've developed relationships with the University of Kansas and find some of their tools very helpful.
Yes, Minniger's was one of the pioneers coming out of Kansas. You should have known that.
Yes.
Mr. Naughton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. We are recommending that you approve both of these requests for submission to the federal government.
Mr. Britt.
Madam Chair, we likewise recommend approval of both grants.
Senator Gordon. Senator Gordon moves.
So moved.
Senator Gordley moves that we accept the recommendation of the LFO staff and send to the full Ways and Means the request of the grant retroactively approve the submission of a federal Department of Human Health and Human Services Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration grant application to develop further training and implementation of evidence-based practices for adults with severe mental illness. And retroactively approve the submission of a federal Department of Health and Human Services Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration grant application to provide transition and substance abuse treatment services for juvenile justice youth. Is there any objection? Not. So, Senator Gordon, would you like to take the full committee?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. And, Madam Chair, if I
could. Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. If I could just make a request of John Britton that in the write-up for the mental health grant, if we could have language that makes that link back to House Bill 3024, the mental health planning bill. I think that's very important to get on record that we are moving forward with that work. even without general fund support.
I will do that.
Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I did not object to that vote, but I do object to being asked to make a decision with respect to how funds are spent without having information. And it's just a very brief summary of how the funds would be budgeted would be very helpful as grant requests come forward in the future.
When grant reports, when applications, and I think you probably got this yesterday, but in the future, if they come before you and any member who wants detail, further detail, you know, we'll make sure you either go through LFO or the agency and get the backup detail. All grant applications that go through the federal government are a lot more detailed than what we receive here. They do include what the project proposed to do. It includes how many staffing, what your service and supplies are. It'll include the component for evaluation. All of those are in that packet that goes, and so certainly I'm sure that can be made available, you know, upon request. It's nothing that if we wanted members to have, we can have that.
I don't want to belabor the point, Madam Chair. It seems to me that the reference budget could have been presented in a one page so that it doesn't become the exception. I don't know how the other committee members would feel, but I personally do take seriously how this money is being spent, and I think we do have an oversight function with respect to... My passion is that it go to where it's intended and not to be creating more plans and more documents that sit on shelves and people don't get help. That's my motivation. So that's why I raised the issue.
I don't know how to respond, because one, you can get access to the information. The brevity that's done here is done so that you get the information. If you want further documentation, you can request it. Under normal circumstances, if we're that happens, we give them the limitation with which they can then exercise. We also give them the permission to apply. Permission to apply does not necessarily mean that they in fact will receive this grant. What we're doing here today is giving them permission to make application to the federal government to apply for these funds. If we were in the interim, they would actually, in some respects, depending on what they ask for, may have to come back to us before they can ever expend dollars to tell us that they got them. But I think in this instance, Mr. Britton tells us that we're also approving their limitation. Are we not, Mr. Britton?
Madam Chair, not directly. Typically, and you're absolutely right, with respect to an emergency board, we will often not give them limitation. We will simply give them approval to apply for a grant, and then if they need additional limitation, they will return, either through a rebalance in the case of the Department of Human Services, or if it's another kind of an agency separately, if they require additional limitation. With respect to this grant, it also depends on when they receive it. Certainly, if they got one of these grants or both of them, they would, in theory, need additional limitation for the 0305 budget, which could be built in, which should be built in, to their budget for the next biennium when this committee does its work.
I guess another part of the question, Madam Chair, would be how frequently are we asked to approve something retroactively?
Normally it's very seldom that we are asked, because agencies have been put on notice not to present us with retroactive requests. In this case, because of everything that's been going on in this building and all the other requests, they couldn't bring it before us because of our own activity and our six special sessions and all these other things that we have going. And that's why they are coming in for retroactive requests. But under normal circumstances, we try to I think the message has been given to all agencies not to come before us with retroactive requests like this. Mm-hmm. Senator Carter.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering and trying to hear what the senator is saying versus what he's been asking. It appeared to me that, I know we used to, John, when things would become before the emergency board, they would have to come back and tell us how they were going to spend the money. And since this is nothing but a request at this time, Senator, I'm not sure how we do that with regular session going on. Will they come back to us and tell how they're going to spend the money? But we can't determine that because it is a federal grant. And because it's spent and broken up into these three sections, that they got to spend so much on research, they got to spend so much on implementation, so much on programmatic, and so much on administration. We don't determine that. What we could do is to see the dollars that has been given to programmatic structure, then we certainly could have some input into that in the state. But that is all determined by the federal government since these are federal grants. If that is helpful. I understand oversight, but I hear your question. Your question is oversight.
Well, Madam Chair, this was delivered to our office on Friday. This is Monday. Mm-hmm. For any legitimate questions with respect to a 42% non-point of service expense, I'm a little frustrated at that. So.
We can't do anything about it because that's the federal government.
Their
dollars. We can't do anything about it. That's their dollars, and that's how they determine.
Yeah. Okay. I'll
no. Well, it's all.
Oh, yeah. It's our dollars. Okay.
Let me see if I can put it because I don't want you to go to put it into maybe somewhat of perspective because we do have new members and we do have individuals who don't understand the process between applying for federal funds, and I'm not talking about the traditional Medicaid or those kind of those funds. Often the federal government will send announcements to the state agencies that they're looking for something specifically, and they will send requests all across the country. We, like all other states, if we have a need or an interest in our state, will respond to those requests for proposals. And then when the Fed set the guidelines on what they're seeking and what they're looking for. And I don't think I've ever remembered whether it's a training proposal. If they're requesting something in training, they will also connect with that training some evaluation or the impact of what happened as a result. That's why I said this is probably a demonstration or if they're looking for some hypothesis, it'll come out as a research piece. But very seldom do they have a huge service delivery component. And the reason that they don't is because they actually are looking at some hypothesis or something that they're trying to prove. And so you will have part of that is actually implementing where the service piece, but a piece of it will also be devoted to evaluation of looking at, what you said you were going to do and these were the outcomes. So that's why if you look at the amount of the 58 versus 42 is because you have the service piece plus the evaluation piece plus whoever has to coordinate it to make it happen. And so you will get that kind of mix if you're dealing with federal research and demonstration grants. Is that about general, Mr. Notton?
Madam Chair, I think you're exactly correct. And if I can clear my throat for a second, that has actually been one of the major frustrations for the emergency board as we've rolled through. I can remember different times when we've had grants to go out and catalog houses with lead-based paint. But there's never been any component to the federal government to actually go and do anything about those. So a lot of the times we are laboratories for the federal government to collect information, collect research, and then send it off and do best practices, but they're very heavily administrative laden. Mm-hmm. I think Madam Chair is exactly correct. It's very frustrating for all people on that.
And on the flip side of that, I've been in situations where there's something that we believe that there's something that we need to study, and we have done, if I can go back in history, when we did freeing children for permanent placement, Oregon was the one who led the way in what is now termination of parental rights. that was a research and demonstration effort that was done that we believed that we needed to look at some of the barriers, some of the problems, and why children were staying in our foster care system so long. And so we took the initiative in that instance, and the federal government funded that for us. You know, that was our grassroots day. So that's kind of that's just unexplainable how this system between us and the federal government works. It doesn't preclude us from having oversight, though, or for us to giving limited duration positions rather than permanent FTEs, because we can still, you know, those are some things that we can do. We can request that they come back to report to this body their outcomes, which you may want to include that we would like to see their outcomes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your patience. You're very kind.
Okay. Well, we will move on to the next chapter. Everybody had good Easter eggs. Nobody put any money in Rosie, though, today.
And all of you guys are useful because I can hear anything.
We ate too many Easter eggs yesterday. Go ahead, James.
Madam Chair, for the record, James Taves from Seniors and People with Disabilities, and with me is Elizabeth Lopez, who will continue her presentation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Elizabeth Lopez, Administrator of the Office of Employment and Financial Benefits in the Department of Human Services, serving seniors and people with disabilities. Are there any additional questions about the issue of income cap trust before I move on to other financial supports and seniors and people with disabilities? With that, I'll move on. The other major support provided in seniors and people with disabilities is access to health care benefits. And most of those benefits are provided through our Oregon Supplemental Income Programs. These are programs that serve individuals who are aged, blind, or have a disability. And the primary support there is basic medical coverage to individuals who qualify for our Oregon Supplemental Income Programs and are under the Supplemental Social Security Income Standard. And we'll get into what those standards are in a couple more slides. We also provide a minimal cash assistance support to individuals who qualify for our Oregon Supplemental Income Programs. This dates back to the implementation of our Supplemental Security Income Program in 1974, where the federal government said to states, individuals must remain harmless. And at that time, our supplemental payment was $12 above what the Social Security supplemental income payment ended up being. In 1991, that amount reduced to $1.70 per month or $20.40 per year. And for individuals who have blindness as a disability, their supplemental payment is $320 per year. We also provide medical.
Now, do we pay this out on a yearly basis, or?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. We pay one annual payment of $20.40, or one annual payment of $320. We also assist individuals with their Medicare premiums. For individuals who are under 100% of the federal poverty level, we assist with their Medicare premium copayments and deductibles. And for individuals from 100% of the federal poverty level to 133% of the federal poverty level, we continue to pay the Medicare premium. And those are federally funded programs. Moving on to slide 109, I mentioned that the Oregon Supplemental Income Program serve individuals who are aged, blind, and disabled. In many cases, this decision has already been made, the disability decision by the Social Security Administration. But in the event that that decision has not been made, the state of Oregon is required to make a disability decision within 90 days from when the individual applies for Medicaid. We cannot require as a condition of eligibility a person apply for Social Security benefits. So if that determination has not been made, we must make that in the Department of Human Services. We make these presumptive Medicaid disability decisions for individuals who are applying for our Oregon Supplemental Income Programs, for individuals who are applying for home and community-based services and for individuals who are applying for our Employed Persons with Disabilities program. Moving on to medical eligibility, people receiving long-term care services receive their critical health care benefit through the Oregon Health Plan, and they qualify for the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit package. That's pretty cut and dry and pretty simple. But when you move on to individuals who are not receiving long-term care services, then the chart gets a little more complicated, and that's the chart that we're showing here on slide 112. Individuals who are eligible for Medicare cannot participate in the Oregon Health Plan. However, they can participate in our Oregon Supplemental Income programs, either as a qualified Medicare beneficiary or a special income Medicare beneficiary. We've broken this chart out for you to explain when individuals who are eligible for Medicare can receive the Oregon Supplemental Income program, and when individuals who are not, what services individuals who are not eligible for Medicare can receive. The other medical support that we provide in seniors and people with disabilities is the Oregon Health Plan and access to the Oregon Health Plan Basic and Oregon Health Plan Plus packages.
Senator Carter,
can you tell me, especially as I look at Standard versus Plus, what will be the effect of the cutting of the OHP and this particular group of people that would be into the standard category?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I mentioned the presumptive disability process, and individuals who are under 100% of the Supplemental Social Security Income Standard who do meet disability based on Social Security criteria will qualify for the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit package. It would be individuals who are above that income standard that would then fall into the OHP standard category.
Okay. Thank you. Since we are cutting the program, so I don't know whether this is in your department directly or... We're throwing off 150,000 people off the health plan. So if some of them fall into the category of Medicare and then they have spent down, how are they going to be eligible? I mean, where's the money going to come from?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, individuals who qualify for Medicare are not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan.
But when they spend down, they are then eligible. And since we are not... Okay, I need to ask some more questions.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, individuals regardless of income who qualify for Medicare are not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan benefit package.
I got my groups mixed up, sorry.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Winters. Last week I raised the question of, does the state of Oregon provide any type of incentive or credit for folks to go out and acquire private insurance to meet these type of needs? And I guess I thought about it over the weekend, and I want to rephrase my question if that's okay. Has any study or analysis been done to see what the savings would be to the state of Oregon if there was an incentive plan for Oregonians to go out and acquire their own before they get into the situations where they need the type of programs we're talking about?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I don't know of any national studies, but that's not to say that they don't exist. And I think Barry Donenfeld is here and may testify tomorrow, and he's been working on legislation on long-term care insurance, and we've tentatively looked at the Hawaii model, but whether there's any kind of research that shows I don't know, but we can certainly look for that and see if any such research exists.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Winters. To our committee, I just really think we're missing an opportunity. Every month, I'll share a personal story. I spend about $55 every month making sure that I have long-term and short-term care insurance. And so in the event that I'm driving out of the Capitol and I get hit, I know that I will be taken care of and my family will be taken care of. And yet I'm not able to write any of that off on my taxes or just a small portion. And to me, it seems like we're missing an opportunity to provide an incentive for folks to take care of themselves. There's a true need for what we're talking about. I see that. But I think there's an opportunity that we're missing. And I don't have the expertise to move on it. I just think there's an opportunity there.
Representative Smith, I'm going to have a staff check. I believe we did pass, or we had, in the House, a tax credit for long-term care. Might not have been at a very high level, but if my memory serves me correctly, and I'll research that to see if that's in play. But it was either 99 or the 01 session.
Well, I know I'm not smart enough to know how to move it forward, but I do think there's an opportunity.
I wonder, Madam Chair, if Representative Smith is also asking another question, which is, it's more than incentive, it's also education.
Yeah.
Both pieces.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we will certainly see if there is any research, and I think this does need to become a very high priority for the department to look at what's out there in terms of long-term care insurance, how we could develop that in Oregon, and how we could promote it very actively amongst the aging community.
I think that not only Oregon, I think it's a real national issue of trying to find a way, and like I said, when I was back in Washington, I did mention that to the president, that we really did nationally need to incentivize this whole long-term care issue. With the baby boomers just 10 years out, states and the federal government are not going to be able to afford the bill. It's going to be a huge bill, and whether we begin the process in Oregon, but maybe other states catch on, but I do think that we need to be looking at long-term. I agree with Representative Smith and others that this is it's a huge issue, and it is one of educating individuals. Some generations grew up knowing that you had to have insurance. There are other generations who have grown up who think they're going to live forever. Nothing ever happens to them. And so they have not planned ahead. So I think it is a huge issue. But Mr. Britton, would you check on that legislation and see if we didn't pass something? I thought it was in 99 or 01.
All right. Moving on to slide 113, we wanted to talk about some of the major reductions in financial supports in the seniors and people with disabilities cluster, starting with the ending of the general assistance program, which provided a cash assistance of $314 a month to certain individuals. We also ended the medically needy program, which provided drug coverage, mental health services, transportation, and full medical benefits to children with disabilities. Although the program budget for the medically needy program is in our Office of Medical Assistance program, these are individuals that are served in our field offices, and it did have very significant impact on our long-term care system. The general assistance program provided $314 cash assistance to individuals who met the disability criteria. A condition of eligibility was that they applied for Social Security disability benefits. They must have been 18 to 64 and have income below the $314 a month standard. These individuals had very low resource thresholds, $1,500 a resource limit, and only $50 of that could have been a cash resource. And another condition of eligibility was that individuals participate in the drug and alcohol treatment program if that was identified by their medical professional. That program ended effective February 1 of 2003, and this affected 2,373 individuals. We have followed those individuals, and there were approximately 400 of those that had applications in our Disability Determination Services Unit. Since the closure of the program, 213 of those have been allowed for Social Security disability benefits, 78 of those have been denied, and 111 are still pending for additional verification. A majority of the individuals who lost benefits had their cases at the Office of Hearings and Appeals in Social Security Administration. We have been in contact with Region 10 of Social Security Administration to see what we could do to expedite that process. They understand our crisis, but do not believe they can expedite all 1,000 cases that are currently there, but they are working with us to ensure that we're sharing information wherever possible to expedite that. The remaining folks either have not applied for Social Security benefits, they have not requested a reconsideration for Social Security benefits, and they are working with our Social Security liaisons in our office to facilitate that offices to facilitate that process. The Medically Needy program provided assistance to individuals with disabilities or individuals who are age 65 or older or children under the age 21 with disabilities. The resource limits for this group were $2,000 for a single person and $3,000 for a couple, and the income limit was $413 or below. Individuals with income above that could spend down into eligibility. So you'll hear a spend down associated with medically needy because we took their income, subtracted the allowable deductions, and once an individual incurred medical expenses that reached their spend down, they became eligible for their prescription medical coverage. This program ended effective February 1 also. There were approximately 8,757 individuals affected by this reduction. 69% were adults with disabilities age 19 to 64. 30% were adults with disabilities, or I'm sorry, were adults age 65 or above, and 1% were children under the age of 21.
We hear a lot of anecdotes about income. Do you have average income levels with this population?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. I did not bring them with me today, but I can certainly get those to you.
Provide us with that information.
I have a question.
Representative Smith.
With the reorg of the Oregon Health Plan, will these numbers still apply of the 8,757 individuals?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I believe they would be in that these are individuals who are considered to be aged, blind, or disabled as a condition of eligibility.
Thank you for that reminder.
Moving on to slide 118, we did want to talk briefly about our Disability Determination Services Unit. This unit was previously in the Vocational Rehabilitation Division, and in the reorganization, it has moved over to the Seniors and People with Disabilities Cluster. This group determines disability for supplemental Social Security income and Social Security disability income, and they adjudicate approximately 45,000 claims per year. There are currently over 125,000 Oregonians receiving Social Security disability benefits in Oregon each month. A couple of things that have happened in this group since in the year 2002, we decreased the processing time from an average of 112 days to an average of 94 days. That was a reduction of about 17%. We did that by eliminating a backlog of over 4,000 claims, and we are now down to a backlog of zero and have remained there since April of 2002. That group is also currently working with Social Security Administration to implement a paperless disability determination process, and we anticipate to have that up and going by January 2004. This is a agenda that the new commissioner, Commissioner Barnhart, has very aggressively set some aggressive timelines, and we believe to be on board by January of 2004.
That's a very good goal.
It is.
That's some pluses for states. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, back on page 118, there's a couple of numbers there that strike me as a little off. 45,000 claims adjudicated per year, but yet there are only 125,000 clients. That seems to be, are there two-thirds that, and a third are making claims and two-thirds are not once they're eligible? Could you explain the relationship between those two numbers, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, sure. We allow approximately 40% of individuals who apply for Social Security disability benefits at their initial determination phase. These are ongoing. The 125,000 are ongoing individuals who receive disability benefits. This program also has individuals that come and go, individuals that either pass away and lose benefits or get well and are no longer eligible for Social Security benefits. So that is a revolving program.
Yeah. Thank you.
And not all of them that you see are determined eligible.
Only 40%.
Only 40%.
And Madam Chair, at initial consideration, 40%. Additionally, we allow about 15% and reconsideration. These are individuals who ask for another consideration of their disability after the initial decision has been made.
Madam Chair, if there are no other questions on this section, we'll move on to page 120, the Older Americans Act. I bring back Mary Lee Fay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay, the Administrator for the Office of Home and Community Supports with Seniors and People with Disabilities. And I want to take a moment to go over our Older Americans Act program. This is a program that's steeped in history, beginning in 1965, and has maintained, I think, the values of the program and the principles of the program throughout that whole period. And that was to enable older adults to live their lives to the fullest with access to all available resources and benefits to which they are entitled. And unlike our long-term care Medicaid program and to some extent OPI, Older Americans Act has a broader agenda than just focusing in on an individual with an individual need. And that's really to strengthen the developed resources within the community and really build access to community resources and information about educational issues and educational opportunities. The type of services that we provide with Older Americans Act include things like support services, which would be case management, family caregiver supports, which allows a family member who's really taken on the full responsibility of supporting a person, their family member, with the additional supports that's needed. Things like medication management and in-home services, elder abuse prevention, and some of the legal services. And legal services here really are often an educational opportunity where there may be an education at the senior center and talking about wills, talking about guardianship issues or financial abuse. So this program often does a tremendous amount of educational and informational type of programs.
Yeah, Chair Winters.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. As you know, we've just been handed the two different budgets, the co-chair's budget and the governor's budget. And in both of those, there's reductions to Oregon Project Independence, and one of them is completely defunded. How much
Older Americans Act money do we lose in the state?
No. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there really is a connection between Older Americans Act funding and Oregon Project Independence. Like most federal programs, we don't get federal dollars without some sort of a commitment. And unlike Medicaid, where there's a dollar for dollar or a 40 cents to 60 cents match rate, Older Americans Act does not have that requirement, but it does have a requirement that the state must demonstrate a shared commitment to the program. In Oregon, we have used Oregon Project Independence as our strategy to tell the federal government that we indeed do look at the, we indeed match our commitment. It's a demonstration that we have a shared population. And we have about 13% of the Oregon Project Independence dollars are our demonstration to maintain the $26 million in the federal dollars to the Older Americans Act. It's about 13%. If indeed Oregon reduces its commitment, whether we use Oregon Project Independence or somewhere else, but that's really been the clearly identified match between outcome and program, we would indeed lose the matching rate for Older Americans Act, and that would happen over time. There really is a tremendous connection. And again, there is a shared population and a shared agenda, but we really do different activities with the two different programs.
Given that, how much on a dollars and cents is that 13% commitment?
It's Madam Chair, it's $1.5 million a year is what we have demonstrated to the federal government that Oregon Project Independence has allowed us to get the full resources of the Older Americans Act.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shield, and then I'll...
Mm-hmm. What you're saying is that we've only, listed $1.5 million of our OPI money out of the $13 million or whatever we have as a maintenance of effort?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, correct. It's considered a maintenance of effort, and so we are able to say that amount of money out of Oregon Project Independence is Oregon's demonstration that we share the federal commitment of Older Americans Act.
Follow up. So how serious is the threat that we could lose the Older American Act money if we don't keep OPI in place?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, unlike Medicaid, it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. So there is the formula? It declines in certain percentages over a multi-year period, and I think we'd get that formula. But it's not again, if you don't put up the match, you don't lose the whole program at the get-go. It's a declining percentage over time.
But I think that we're interested in seeing what that formula is and what the implications are over time.
Madam Chair, we can bring that back to you on what the formula is.
Is that what you were going to ask, Senator Carter? Is that what you...
Basically, I just want to see what the formula is, the MOE.
Mm-hmm.
Got to do it.
Thank you.
The eligibility, as I said, the program has some similarities to other programs for seniors, but in this one, the eligibility is really a general service, that you have to be 60 years of age or older, there is not an income standard. Although there are targets that the federal government, through Older Americans Act, ask us to stay involved with. There's requirements about family caregivers. In Older Americans Act, there is an Older Worker Employment Services. Much of this is a subsidized work experience that we work with our local partners in the community. And the services that are targeted to older individuals with the greatest social or economic needs are one of the targets, with a special focus on low-income minority individuals and individuals living in rural areas.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon,
what does the Act require regarding prescriptions, access to prescriptions?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, prescription
medication?
This particular program does not cover and doesn't require prescription medication coverage. It doesn't allow for it. In other words, this is not a program that will cover those costs, nor does it require it that I'm aware of. But I will follow up to see if there are any other state connections between Oregon having a program for I'm assuming what you're wanting to know is, does Oregon need to have a program for prescription medication?
I'm just wondering if the Act had any language with regard to prescriptions, access to prescriptions. I know it talks about medication management, but aside from that.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'll follow up on the language specific to that.
Thank you.
Would you provide us with a description of what support services are?
Support services really are case management, information and referral. So it is general information and assistance. So somebody who's coming looking for a connection can get it through that support services. So it's a generic term for case management here.
And is the family caregiver supports respite?
It involves respite. Madam Chair, the family caregiver supports involve just both respite as well as education and information. There may be educational strategies on teaching family members on how to use particular equipment for physical assistance or lifting devices, things like that. So it's education and respite.
And most of these services contracted out?
Madam Chair, these services are delivered through our area agencies on aging, who primarily manage the support services and use local contractors as well to deliver the services, anywhere from home-delivered meals to congregate meal sites at the senior centers.
And most of that's through the counties, right?
Yes, Madam Chair. The diversity initiatives that are also a large part of the activities under Older Americans Act, again, there are some targeted activities, and things that we have done here in Oregon is coordinate with tribes. There are a number of tribes that are also located in areas where area agencies on aging operate, and so we look to have specific outcomes on how they are coordinating their services. There are performance measures, such as the number of people receiving services that are part of an ethnic minority, that needs to be reported not only to the state but back to the federal government. Promoting diversity in Area Agency on Aging staffing and volunteers, making sure that there are people who represent ethnic minorities, language issues that are available and present, and things like ethnic meal sites, targeted outreach, and other community services through senior centers.
Do you compile an annual or biennial report on the results or what's occurring under the Older Americans Act?
Madam Chair, we do put that report together for the federal government, and I can make that available to the committee.
I think it would, considering that we're talking about a lot of issues, and I think that the members of this body would be interested in knowing what, number one, what the outcomes were of the work that's being done through the area agencies on aging, as well as some of the performance measures that are required in the contracts with the area agencies on aging. See, I didn't say that three-letter word.
The population served, again, since this is a program that has such broad outreach and context, there are many Oregonians who receive these services. So we have over 130,000 older adults have received support services annually. Another 1,250 individuals 55 years of age or older receive employment and training supports each year. And approximately 35% of Older Americans Act clients have incomes at or below federal poverty level. That's a very broad range of services that reach many individuals. 65% of clients live in rural communities, and 6% are clients are of an ethnic minority.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Given what you have displayed here, which gives us the detail on population served, what can you tell us about the number of people who are actually eligible? Has our outreach, what percentage of the eligibles are we serving in each of these categories? Or have we reached all of the eligibles?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, is your question in terms of eligible for Older Americans Act, in terms of that? We can give you, I don't have it with me here today, but we can have a breakout in terms of the general population and then where we are with reaching those particular goals and outreach.
I'm particularly looking at the last two bullets. Okay. 65% of the clients live in rural communities. What percent of the eligibles is that? And then the 6% of the clients who are minority, again, what percentage of the eligibles is that?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, I don't have that with me, but I know we have it in our report, so I'll bring that back.
So that we know where we're
how we're doing with the outreach and that, yes.
Underserved populations. Yes.
And lastly, on Older Americans Act, again, the state distributes these federal funds to the area agencies on aging, and we use a federally approved funding formula that looks at everything from population-based to square mileage and numbers of people who would be eligible in those services. And as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, there are, of course, federal requirements that the state does participate in a shared commitment. And so that although this is these dollars that are part of Older Americans Act, which is about $25 million, $26 million, are not needing a dollar-for-dollar match from the state, we do need to provide, as Senator Shields referenced, a maintenance of effort.
So is OPI just one of the maintenance of effort sources, or are there other MOEs?
Madam Chair, what we would have to do is say how through the general fund, how through not using federal dollars would we do that. It has been the only place in seniors and people with disabilities budget that has met that outcome. We would have to look elsewhere for service dollars that we don't have a program in mind.
Inside of the area agency on aging's budget is more than just the $25,000 base amount.
Madam Chair, yes. That's just the amount per on how they begin their formulas, and each agency is given their own budget. They also must come up with local match. So the state has to show a commitment, but also at the local level, each of those organizations also has to show a match. That can be an in-kind type of thing, and what we'll see is often our communities have used Older Americans Act to really leverage quite a bit of local partnership at the local level and getting commitments from a broad array of other organizations who really partner with them in creating a larger system.
Does your report include that kind of information as to the local participation, state participation, federal dollars, and all that on a statewide basis?
Madam Chair, our report says what they have to be able, what each area has to be able to demonstrate in terms of a local match. Our plans that each area agency sends to the state every biennium on how they manage these services as well as Oregon Project Independence will indicate how they are doing local matching. So in one format or another, we do have that information and can get that to you.
So they report to you once a year, annually? But I would like to have that information. I think we've on a statewide basis of what is the local contribution, what is the state, what is the federal, the same kind of information that you would send to the federal government, who served, how they're served. And I know that last session we talked a lot about performance measures and and making certain that those contracts that you entered into with the Area Agency on Aging, that the outcomes were included in the contract. So it would be helpful to know, since we've had, it's been a while now since those budgets went forward, as to see what those results are.
Madam Chair, we'll include that in information.
Madam Chair, with that, we're ready to begin protective services and...
Thank you. I do have a question about the funding formula. Could you say more about the base funding for each agency and help me understand how you look at demographics and what square mileage of each area has to do with the funding formula?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I can bring back for you how we have allocated and looked at each area so you can see how it plays out. One of the reasons where square mileage plays into the factoring is, again, the issue and concern of targeting individuals in rural areas and looking at large area of expanse and low population and making sure that the capacity for those agencies are there to deliver similar types of outcomes. But I can bring back how we have done those allocations and look at the formulas and how they were played into the each area.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. James.
Okay, Madam Chair, we're ready to turn to page 129. And Kathy Cooper, the Acting Deputy for Seniors and People with Disabilities, is going to present this. Cindy Hannum, who's our head of our Office of Licensing and Quality of Care, is sick from food poisoning, so Kathy is going to present in her place today.
Good morning. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Kathy Cooper, the acting deputy.
She was eating Easter eggs.
I'm the acting deputy assistant director for seniors and people with disabilities. And I apologize that I am not as well versed as Cindy, so she promises with every question that she will provide very adequate answers if I am unable to do that this afternoon. What we wanted to spend some time on this afternoon is two areas of our service delivery in senior and people with disabilities that really serves the public at large. It's not restricted to people that are under state-funded programs. Those are community protective services and our licensing and quality assurance. We have a statutory obligation to protect vulnerable seniors, people, adults with physical disabilities, and children and adults with developmental disabilities from any physical or mental abuse. And through our statutory authority, we take this responsibility very seriously for all Oregonians. We look at areas that we've identified at the bottom of page 129 around abandonment, financial exploitation, neglect, it could be self-neglect or caregiver neglect, physical abuse, psychological abuse, sexual abuse, and self-neglect. The number one and number two types of abuse that we see for community protective services is physical abuse and neglect by caregivers. And in our facilities, most often we see neglect caused by the failure of the provider to provide adequate and proper care for clients. The most vulnerable population we see in our records are people 85 and older. They are the most vulnerable in our communities, but for protective services, they too, as a growing population, because they have dementia, Alzheimer's, and because of self-neglect, we see that becoming our highest incidence of areas for protective services. We have protective service activities through all of our offices, whether it's our state-operated community human services offices, our AAA, our area agencies on aging offices, or our county offices with our developmental disabilities, are all have a responsibility for investigations of allegations of abuse. I've provided for you on page 130 those statistics around our protective services for last year, 2002. You'll see broken out by our licensed facilities, the number of complaints we have received, and then our community protective services, and those for persons with developmental disabilities through our county investigations.
Now, under your license facility complaints investigation, how many of those do the Area Agency on Aging follow up on, and how many of them are followed up by the long-term care ombudsman?
Madam Chair, these are followed up.
The same stats.
Madam Chair, these are followed up typically by our staff, and then in licensed facilities, there are times where our client care monitoring unit also, which are under federal certification and requirements, do go in and also investigate if it becomes more serious. But most of those are investigated firsthand by our field staff throughout the state.
So how does your field staff interface with or interact with the long-term care ombudsman?
Madam Chair, Cindy could probably give the best answer. I know we're in regular communication with them on that, but I can't give you the details of which cases are communicating and how often, but we can certainly get that for you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. And thank you. I'd like to see the protective service statistics for year 2002 broken out a bit differently. I'd like to see them broken out by the categories of abuse that you have listed on the previous page, which is looks like seven categories.
Great.
And then if you have an other, I'd like
Great.
To see other listed as well. I'd also like to know how many people work in this area, community protective services. How many are, if you call them caseworkers or case managers, how many are there? What is today the total number of active cases in each one of those seven categories? And if you have a way of saying, of describing what is an average caseload, what is that number? And then if you could address the issue of capacity. Are there enough staff working in the community protective services area to handle the caseload? Today's caseload.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we will return with all of the detail on the categorization of abuse. We will also come back with the numbers of staff doing adult protective services, and we will come back with an average caseload. We can just tell you right now that our capacity to do the current work in our offices is very lacking. Right now, our staffing allocation level is 1 to 195 abuse cases. It is an enormous workload for our staff, and as we continue to describe our continuing reduction in the number of clients receiving services and people in our community becoming older, the vulnerability of our population continues to increase in the number of protective services calls and requests for follow-up and investigation and of abuse continues to escalate. So we will come back with a finer detail for you.
And, Madam Chair,
follow up.
Thank you. I would also then like to see the information that tells us the average length of time that it takes to open and then close a case. And you could add another category, and that would be a category that shows us the number of these cases that result in criminal charges or some other kind of legal action.
being taken. And then finally, Madam Chair, to hear that these folks are dealing with 195 abuse cases per person is just outrageous.
Yeah.
We couldn't agree more.
I would also like to know in your collection of where your referral sources are from, and whether they're coming from the individual, whether they come from relatives, whether they come from the long-term care ombudsman. Since both of you do investigations, I'd like to know if there is some overlap or some duplication of effort on the part of what you're doing and what they're doing.
So, Madam Chair, we'll be glad to return with all of your questions answered. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I don't know that we've been explicit enough either about how the budgets, the two budgets, the co-chair budget and the governor's budget, treat this particular category.
Okay.
Community Protective Services. We need to look at that, since there is an issue of these folks having too many cases.
I don't believe we've gotten into the detail on those two budgets yet.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't think there's a difference in case laws between the two different budgets, as far as I know.
If we could,
but that's something we will look at. Yeah.
The other thing, Madam Chair, we'll see if we can break out. We uniquely operate under several statutes for protective services. When the divisions merged and changed in the department's reorganization, we have a separate statute for mental health and developmental disabilities, and then for seniors and people with physical disabilities. And the criteria are slightly different. The time frames are slightly different. And over time, I think the department and the legislature needs to address what we're going to do for all vulnerable adults. But you'll see some variation in response times just based on the statutes themselves. But I think we'll try to footnote that so you have a sense of that.
Well, it would be helpful if you could separate it out. So, you know, we understand that there are a lot of pieces and that there are a lot of categories. I think we're both, I know Senator Gordon and I both want to try to get our hands around what really is occurring in protective services for the elderly and for citizens with disabilities, people with disabilities. And when I look at nursing home facilities, residential care, assisted living, foster care, 24-hour residential homes, you both license as well as you have the responsibility for, you know, for follow-up on investigations and protective services. So we're just trying to get clearly the scope and the magnitude of the problem and the issue. And that would be very helpful, Senator Gordon. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. Additionally, I would be very interested to see some information that tells us more about the training that the Community Protection Services folks are getting. Is training jeopardized in either of the budgets that we have before us now, co-chairs, governors? Again, the issue of training and staff development for people who are already clearly overworked. They must be exhausted. Can't imagine.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has there been any consideration to integrate with the faith-based communities, the ability or to reach into those communities to find resources to help do investigations, because I think obviously the motivations are very much the same. People might be willing to step up and provide assistance to find data, essentially data collection, to report to a supervisor to help sort out claims that are substantive versus claims that are not. Has there been any consideration to draw on that resource?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I certainly know with the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and Senator Winters is probably the expert on that, that has been famous for putting together a network of broad-based community participants, including volunteers, in its activities. In terms of
What the state does, though, on the statutory side of investigating abuse, no, we historically have not used volunteers, and I think if we ever explored that, there would be legal issues we'd have to address in terms of, well, probably more than confidentiality, just liability, because we get into some very, very difficult situations where the liability issue for a volunteer probably would come to play, and we would have to look at that.
There may be opportunities to encourage persons from the faith communities to actually become employees, but become a low pay employee to do it as a for own personal interest in taking care of those in need. Change the paradigm a little bit, you know, so that you would have the full training and sanction, but you might wind up with people that are willing to be a low-paid volunteer.
Part of on the long-term care ombudsman side of it, those individuals are volunteers who are trained and who work, within that community and do assist in that vein without remuneration. And I don't know, you'll hear from them next week of how many volunteers that they currently have statewide. Under the this particular effort here, there is not the same kind of volunteer mix because you're often are dealing with, and I would just guess, some issues that could be very, very legal in nature and could create some problems for the person. But we do, on the one hand, have the one that is volunteer that works with the nursing homes and some of those facilities under the auspices of the long-term care ombudsman, and they are trained. And I think we're going to hear them next Monday, and you will hear how many people that they recruit, that they train, that they supervise, that do provide some assistance to the state. My question is to look at how those two operations are mirroring each other and whether or not there is some duplication of effort between the two, what they're doing over here versus what they're doing over there. But that's a thought of, I don't quite sure how it works. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, we certainly will look into that for you and be able to respond probably on Wednesday when we're back. To continue on protective services,
well,
just to give you
an idea of what someone could do. Under our existing statute.
Mm-hmm. Under protective services, about 40% of all of the complaints that we receive are substantiated complaints. About 30 to 40% of those are in our licensed facilities. And when we look across our facility types, there really is no facility that actually stands out having more substantiated complaints than another. The department over time uses sanctions on facilities in about a third of the cases. So I hope that helps answer a little bit of the questions that Senator Gordley had posed. We also have tried to reach out, as Senator Morris has suggested, to look at some abuse prevention grants. And these grants we have received from the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Administration on Aging. And we have training that we've been able to provide under federal grants to help us with education and training in our communities with a whole number of community members to help them both identify and help us with abuse prevention. We train law enforcement officers, district attorneys, and judges, and to help them identify and understand what abuse of the elderly and people with disabilities is. We have a partnership right now with the Department of Consumer and Business Services to train seniors about Medicare fraud.
We have a partnership that has been going on for several years, which was part of a Department of Justice grant, and that is to work with Oregon bankers to help stop financial exploitation and abuse. In this training, we spend a great deal of time helping bank tellers and those that come in contact with seniors and people with disabilities to help them to identify bank fraud and financial abuse. We have a recent grant that helps us with Oregon tribes to enhance response to elder abuse, and the department just received a national award for a video that was developed here in Oregon called The Sacred Circle to help people on the reservations and on tribal areas work with elders and to try to identify abuse. And lastly, we have a great deal of support from Department of Justice and other grants to develop interdisciplinary teams at our local communities, which help our communities, our law enforcement, our medical, our case managers, our adult protective service staff, and others come together to help the community respond to types of abuse and to have a better ability to have informed responses and to be able to help clients that find themselves in an abusive situation. We have many challenges, as Senator Gordley and others this afternoon have presented, around protective services. As James Taves described in his opening comments on our first day, the demographics of Oregon continue to identify people 85 and older as the most vulnerable in our community, and those are the group where we find the most neglect and other types of abuse because of dementia and other aging factors. We also have an increase in the number of reports of abuse and self-neglect, and the need in our long-term care system to respond to those is really lacking at this time. We have limitations in our ability to locally respond promptly. Our statutory requirements for nursing facilities is a 60-day response from the time the call comes in to the time of completed reports. We can tell you that we are rarely meeting that goal because of the lack of staff to be able to do that.
Let me see if I got this right. 60 days.
Yes, that's correct. That's the statute requirement for our nursing facilities, and we have used it as a standard across all of our care settings. Our difficulty is our staff just cannot respond in that manner. Our staff triage and our staff go out and make sure that the client is safe and that the client is in a safe and non-abusive environment. But the time it takes them to follow up and do the federal and state mandatorily required reporting is very, very difficult.
Let me ask you, do you do trends of where you have repeat violations? And what happens if those violations are consistently repeated?
Madam Chair, if that's in a facility, it falls under our licensing requirements, and we do have a number of actions that we can take. We can take sanctions. We can do civil penalties. We can do a declaration of
and a part of your information, I want, and part of the information back to us, would you provide us with whether you have issued some civil penalties? You have to give us the name of the place, but how much you have over and that kind of information.
Yes, we'd be glad to present that to you.
Senator Carter.
In bringing back some questions about 5 years ago, there were a series of situations that happened in long-term care situations and in our nursing facilities regarding senior services. I thought close to contact time in terms of the amount of time between when an abuse occurs and you know about it and the time by which you go to investigate it. And I thought we'd done better than 60 days. And so if you could get back to us on that.
I think they want to correct it now.
Yeah, I think sure. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm Elaine Young. I'm the Nursing Home Program Manager and the Corrective Unit Manager for Seniors and People with Disabilities. I just wanted to correct one statement, in that our response time is not 60 days. The 60-day requirement is for the report to be written.
Okay.
In instances of...
That's a huge difference.
Yes. We have a two-hour and a next-day response time for issues of abuse.
See, you just saw my hair just instantly got gray. Well, thank you for clarifying that. I can sleep better tonight.
Good.
Madam Chair, we've also, on the developmental disability side, and it's something we'd like to expand on, is we developed a secure web-based site where we collect all abuse information and major medical incidents and other major incidents that really does lend itself. You can pull up by person, by site, by facility. It gives us tremendous ability to do trend analysis, and I think those are the kinds of data systems that our federal partners are really asking states to have to show how you manage that information and how you change how you attack the abuse problem based on those kinds of trends. So I think that's something that we're very committed to.
I just personally think it's very sad, and it's a sad commentary in a supposedly civil society that we have to talk about having to protect our most vulnerable children and seniors. I just, to me, to look at these stats, the number of individuals and complaints that you investigate, it's just hard to comprehend that we care so little that, we don't care enough about another human being who is becoming very, very chronologically advantaged. And we all know that as we progress in this world, that we don't do things at the same level that we did when we were spry and energetic. And I just think it's just a sad commentary. I just have to say that. This committee selected as its most vulnerable for this budget was seniors and children, that don't have not only the voice, but are often in conditions because of aging that they can't fend for themselves. But these stats are just... I didn't mean to interrupt your presentation, so you can continue, and then I have an announcement to make.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last point we wanted to make emphasis on protective services is, as the erosion of our long-term care system increases, the potential for abuse and for self-neglect continues to escalate. And our greatest concern is what happens to people that we're not able to provide care to and services to over the next several years because of our budget impact.
Madam Chair, shall we continue, or?
You might as well continue, because tomorrow we're going to have public testimony. Comment.
Madam Chair, we can finish licensing, and maybe that's a good segue point.
Yeah, that'd be a good tool.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the second part of our services that we provide to all Oregonians is in the area of licensing and quality assurance. Really, our efforts in the area of licensing are to protect the health and safety and to protect and promote the best practices in all of our licensed facilities. We have state statute that governs this activity, and it helps protect our federal ability to get home and community-based waivers and to ensure that health and safety is a part of those waivered services in Oregon. Seniors and people with disabilities licenses nursing facilities, residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, adult foster homes, and all 24-hour residential homes for persons with developmental disabilities, including foster homes and group homes. We also certify programs for people with developmental disabilities, and those typically are investigated and are inspected annually, and those comprise our employment, our supported living sites, and our brokerage services, to name a few. We also have a client care monitoring units, and you were just able to meet our manager, Elaine Young, who manages those three sites around the state. She is responsible with her units to do the annual inspections of nursing facilities. These are in federal compliance with the survey and certification requirements of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They also do surveys for residential care and assisted living facilities every other year. Oregon provides the service under a contractual relationship with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. In our local offices, our AAA, our Area Agencies on Aging, and our Community Human Services offices and our Developmental Disability County offices provide annual inspections for our adult foster homes across the state. Senior and people with disabilities inspects and licenses 24-hour residential homes for people with developmental disabilities on a biannual basis, but they annually do reviews on those that usually have areas of conformity or noncompliance, and so we go in and do annual reviews in those settings. In our complaint investigations, which is a part of all of our licensed facilities in Oregon, we conduct really for the purpose of protection of clients and for trying to determine what the actual facts were in any given abuse complaint. We try to gain compliance through corrective action, through education and training that we've described, to try to increase the quality of the care that anyone receives in any of our licensed facilities. We try to correct bad practices that cause harm to clients, and only if we have to do we move to sanctioning, to civil penalties, to restrictions on admissions. In Oregon, in the last year, we have collected about $200,000 in sanctions from facilities that were noncompliant. The nursing facilities are under stricter federal regulations, and the federal government can come in under federal policy for a bad survey that would have been conducted by our client care monitoring unit, and they can also apply a civil penalty. In Oregon, we have only had about 12 in the last year, so we believe that we have done really well in this area.
How does that compare nationwide or with other states?
Madam Chair, I will certainly find that information out for you. I do not have that with me. And then the last area is restrictions on admissions for nursing facilities only. It's a state sanction, and it actually puts a sign on a nursing facility door basically saying that there are no admissions because of some kind of compliance and severe action. In Oregon, we have not used that sanctioning in several years, so we've had no one under that in the last biennium or longer. What we would say is that we believe the quality of care in our facilities is good. We have some bad facility operators and providers, and usually that's where the majority of sanctions come. We see repeated activities to the point where we have to revoke licenses. In Oregon, we have about 6 under suspension right now, and we have very few that we have done a revoking of a license. On the next page, on page 186, we show the state required licensing inspections for all our 24-hour facilities. Nursing facilities, we have from the 9th to the 15th month to do that annual review, and 10% of those reviews have to be done on what we would call non-traditional work hours, where we pop in during weekends and evenings just to make sure the facility has the adequate staffing and that there's adequate care given to clients on weekends and on evenings. Our numbers include both seniors and people with physical disabilities, as well as our developmental disability foster homes, and the 24-hour residential homes at the bottom of the page are typically our developmental disability homes.
couple things, and thank you. And if you get that information back to us, James, tomorrow we will have public testimony on House Bill 5030, and I would ask, I've lost my members, but Mr. Britton, tell the members that they need to be here tomorrow. I will start on time, and it will be a full day tomorrow, just so that you know. And because we expect a lot of individuals here tomorrow, Hearing Room C has been reserved as an overflow for those citizens who can't make it into this room. And we also need to be out of Hearing Room C by 2:45, because there's another group who comes in at 3 o'clock. So there will be those who are in Hearing Room C that they will have to vacate at 2:45, just so that you know. But we do expect a large a group of citizens here tomorrow to be with us. On Wednesday we'll be back with the department on House Bill 5030, and we had originally scheduled Thursday for the long-term care ombudsman, but we will not hear that until Monday.
That hearing is canceled.
So with that, I had wanted to introduce Dr. Norwood, who was in the audience, but there he is. We can say Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, who is on the President's Commission on Mental Health, is with us today. Well, I will. With that, we are adjourned, and I will see you tomorrow at 1 p.m. sharp.